Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's In Forum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Dan Malthrop, co-author of Teachers Have It Easy, former teacher at San Lorenzo High School, former public radio host as well, and co-founder of the Civic Commons. Tonight, we're gathered here to present Inforum's 21st Century Visionary Award to Dave Eggers. If you didn't discover Dave in the 90s through Might Magazine, you might have become aware of him through a certain memoir that he wrote shortly after the 90s, or a slew of other books, including What is the What, The Wild Things, Zaytoon, and others. He has also been a part of founding 13 nonprofits, one publishing house with six different publications. He's obviously on a mission to change the world, to change education. We're very grateful that he is on that mission. And we're here to talk about all of it. So let's get started. Dave Eggers, welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you, Dan.
So let's start. Just before this program began, we heard from a former student of yours, Bianca Catalan, who started at 826 Valencia when she was 12 years old. And in a lot of ways, she seems as though she's a testament to what's possible.
Well, Bianca's obviously incredibly gifted and smart and talented in a lot of different ways. And we were able to meet her at a young age and support her in a lot of the dreams and, goals that she already had. She went to Everett Middle School, which is where 826 Valencia started as a space on Valencia Street in the Mission District, but we also have satellite spaces where we have classrooms at Everett Middle School and James Lick Middle School, and we provide tutors all day at these classrooms. And that gives us a chance to work directly one-on-one with all the students in those schools that wouldn't necessarily come to us or couldn't. So that's where Bianca first got acquainted with 826 and then took workshops and then she was in my class some years later as a high school student.
That was the class that you teach on Tuesday nights, the non-required reading class.
Yeah, every Tuesday night for 10 years now, from 6 to 8 in the basement of McSweeney's. We used to have it at 826, but now it's in the basement of McSweeney's to make room for other workshops at 826. There's about 20 high schoolers from all over the Bay Area that we meet in the basement. And then we talk about contemporary literature. We read everything from Grant to Paris Review, Kenyon Review, Mother Jones, and then we discuss it. We break it down. We talk about what we like and we don't like, and then we actually put an anthology together called The Best American Non-Required Reading. And Bianca was in that class.
When you do that, how much stuff are you and the students reading, and how much gets into the anthology?
Well, we read thousands of pages over the course of the year, and then the book is 300 odd pages. So it's a brutal Darwinian system, and only the strong survive. But the students, it's a real thing because there's a book at the end of it. So the voting and the discussions get really intense. And just last Tuesday, it was really it was a tough one. There was a piece that we read that really divided the class, and
I won't ask you to tell everybody what it was.
No, I won't. I don't want the authors to know what happens in that class. It's sometimes a bloodbath, and you wouldn't want to hear it.
That must be really exciting to have students, public school students from around the Bay Area,
yeah,
taking on these writers who. Maybe who people think a lot of,
yeah,
right? And then you've got a 16-year-old kid who's saying, yeah, not so much.
yeah. Every year, also, there's a student. Last year, it was a kid named Will, and this year is a kid named Carlos, who we call the hammer. Each year, there's one student that just does not like much, and it's really hard to get through. and sneaks up and through. And so Carlos is the hammer, and he loves this title. And, you know, once a month he likes one thing, and everyone's like, "Whoa, yeah, the hammer." But it, you know, the passion that they have for this reading. And when I was in high school, I didn't know what the Paris Review was, or, you know, I didn't know much about contemporary literature.
When I was in high school, we got the New Yorker.
Yeah.
And I looked at the cartoons.
Oh, yeah, they were very good. You didn't understand them. Yeah,
I didn't understand them. And I thought, and I was baffled by, like, the amount of words in the magazine. I was how do you make it through this?
There's a lot of them, yeah. But, you know, the students, we find some stuff that the students read, but mostly it's stuff that they find. So we subscribe to a couple hundred magazines and journals. We get them. The kids look through it, pour through it. If they find a story they like.
Students are shoving the Paris Review and Grant in their backpacks and taking them home.
They have to take 3-4 home every week. And then they go through, and anything they think is worthy of discussion, we make copies of it for the class, and that's what we talk about. And so you give them ownership over the reading list, which is a thing, as a former high school teacher, you know, is a good plan. And we've learned it from other high school teachers that, you know, giving students some ownership and participation in the reading list really kind of gets them invested. And
what's
so
what's really neat too is that it's really you're preparing them and giving them practice in reading adult level text that they, and I mean, I would imagine the transference of skills over to, like, being able to understand your biology textbook or whatever is just, it's baked in.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
when do we get to start testing your students to see if the skills are...
Yeah. I was thinking about that. I don't know if everybody knows, but Daniel and I met the first couple of years of 826 Valencia. Daniel, why do I say Daniel? I can call you Dan.
You can call me Dan.
Dan was a high school teacher at San Lorenzo. And
when you guys opened the doors, you threw this teacher appreciation event that I think Nineveh put together, wherever Nineveh is, who deserves
Nineveh,
a
Caligari,
massive round of applause.
The real force behind 826.
Nineveh, who is also a co-authored Teachers Have It Easy with us. And there was an amazing and inspiring event, and I, like many teachers, showed up at that event not knowing what to expect. Yeah. Somebody took my picture with a Polaroid camera and put it up on the wall in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And they went around the walls everywhere. Just some, the bathroom had empty space.
Yeah.
And
it sounds very strange when you put it out of context like that. It was really nice at the time. Anyway.
But at the moment, I was like, I mean, my sense, and I think this was shared by my colleagues who were with me and others, was that I can't wait to figure out what to do with 826 Valencia. I can't wait to figure out how to connect my students with this place.
Well, we had to make it clear, and Nineveh was a longtime teacher at Leadership High School here in the city, and she really took what was a very vague idea on my part of 826, and I had signed the lease. Well, all we really, you know, we have this publishing company, McSweeney's, and I thought, and I had a lot of friends who were teachers, and they said, you know, boy, we could use some help after school maybe, or kids that are falling behind in their writing skills. And I said, well, I've got a lot of, you know, staff and interns and people like that. And way back in the day at Might Magazine, we used to host groups from the YMCA who would come in and learn magazine publishing. And so that was in the back of my mind. And so we signed a lease at 826 that McSweeney's was in the back of the building and the tutoring center was in the front. So at 2:30 or 3, when the kids started coming in, the staff would take a few hours off, and they were the tutors at first. And, you know, but we were very disorganized, and we didn't have trained educators on staff, and that's when Nineveh came and took that very vague idea and built 826 into everything that it became. And but she,
which is now, like, I mean, you've got eight regional or local 826 centers in New York and Los Angeles and Ann Arbor, Michigan, and all sorts of other places.
Yeah,
and it's inspired these models of how you could create a writing center with a kind of a hip retail element. And in, you know, places like Copenhagen and Cleveland.
Yeah. This is, Daniel came on stage wearing one of our, hooks, for those who have been, dismembered. And these are fairly new. The pirate store manager, Justin Carter, has commissioned these from a craftsman who makes these from scratch, and they'll custom make them to your specifications. But they're beautifully done.
They're really nice. I mean, this is real tooled leather and iron, forged iron.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it's no joke. But you know, back to that teacher appreciation, it was really important at the beginning. And we're going to be all over the map. It was really important, and Nineveh as an educator really emphasized this, and is to make sure that the teachers in the city knew that we were there to support them and not to create some other, you know, program that was working at cross purposes from what they were doing every day in the classroom. We were going to raise and train a tutor army to serve them in the curricula and lesson plans that they already had planned. And that's when you came in, class.
Because the call to action, I mean, Nineveh said, you know, tell us what you need and we'll help.
Right.
So I was the faculty advisor to the school literary magazine, and we wanted to reinvent it. So I said, I want to reinvent the literary magazine. And Nineveh said, okay, bring your kids.
Yeah.
And we field tripped them over from San Lorenzo in the East Bay, and it was this giant adventure for everybody. And then, you know, we got there, and they had, you know, on floppy disks at the time, I think it was.
Not floppy disks.
Not the big ones.
It was like the 80s. What are you talking about, floppy disks?
But we had all of it.
Some sort of disk, yeah.
Some sort of diskette. Yeah. We had all the material that we wanted to publish, and we had no idea what to do.
Right.
And then you took the day with them and taught them about, you know, taught them things about magazine design and style that I think really changed their lives in a lot of ways, because suddenly they realized that you can make these decisions and you shouldn't use, say, every font available
yeah.
to you.
That's always
you should
first
pick
thing.
One.
Is that we don't have to use every one. There's hundreds, and three will do. But I, you know, that the first classes that I taught at 826 were design and zine publishing classes.
Yeah.
And you know, young people take to this so quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really useful skill, and also to collapse the space between what their work is on the page or, you know, handwritten, and publishing it in a dignified and adult, you know, and kind of professional way.
Yeah.
And then getting it out there and amplifying it. And the zine that San Lorenzo made, was it a for sale in the pirate store? And we had to go back to press many times on it.
That's very exciting.
And people go in and they buy these books, and all the books that I have here, written by different high schools all over the Bay. This was from June Jordan last year. Put this together with an introduction by Khaled Husseini, who came to the school twice and visited them. And it's amazing to see how quickly they step up and they own it, and they put together these incredible publications that you wouldn't guess were written by high schoolers. But if you've held them to a professional standard throughout the process, they'll rise to that challenge every time. And that's what the Best American Non-Required Reading does. But, you know, what we talk a lot about, though...
Let me circle back to something about the Best American Non-Required Reading in the class.
Just totally I'm blocked me there. Yeah,
no, but I think I know where
point.
You're going. I think I know where you're going.
All right. When we met, he was a high school teacher, then he got a graduate degree. Now he's Mr. Fancy Pants public radio host. And now you can just sort of stop me cold.
I'm in charge of this conversation. No.
Boy. He came all the way from Cleveland just to interrupt me. Yeah.
Touche. Before this event, we were talking about your experience teaching the Best American Non-Required Reading class. And you said something very interesting to me about it. You said a couple of things. You said it is the best part of your week. And you also said that if there was a test involved, you'd quit.
Well, I don't know if I would quit right away. All I know is that these 2 hours... are electrifying. I can't sleep after the class. Like, I have to really, like, come down from it, because it's so exhilarating, just seeing, like, the ideas bounce around and everything. And 9 times out of 10, I read the same time that the students do. We all read for the first hour, then we discuss it the second hour. So I don't have any answers ahead of time. I read it while they do. And it's rare when I have the story figured out when we start discussing it. But over the course of that hour, we break it down together, and they break it down, and I just sort of guide the conversation, and they explain the story to me. You know, we figure it out together, and what works and why it works and what the author's trying to do. And I just find it electric, you know. And for 10 years, it's been, you know, the best part of my week, outside of all my time with my family and friends.
Naturally. No.
But, you know, as a teaching experience. And then I thought, well, then I talked to friends of mine who teach, and we talk about this, like, I don't know what I would do. I don't know how you would measure what the students learn in this class. I see incredible progress over the course of a year. I see students who are very shy and kind of, you know, reluctant to express their ideas about something or don't know who Joyce Carol Oates is and people like that. And then by the end, they just own it. And they are, you know, graduate level awareness and ability to sort of assess and analyze this work. And I don't know how it would show up on a test. If there was a test at the end of it and I was being held accountable for what they learned, and there's some measurement and this metric, and if they didn't learn what some test administered or, you know, conceived, you know, 1,000 miles away said that they should learn, then it made me a bad teacher, or if they were failing, you know, all these, punitive measures.
Weren't that good
at
taking the test that day?
Yeah, whatever it was, it would take all the joy out of it for me. And so many, you know, teachers are up against this, you know, and there's sort of it's tough to think, like, you know, it should be such a joyful experience teaching.
Well, it is.
And it is. And then if you think, boy, they're going to come down on me like this hammer if somehow whatever magic is happening in this classroom doesn't show up on the Scantron form and isn't, you know, measurable.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
I do.
And as a teacher yourself, how did you sort of balance those two things?
I ignored the tests.
Yeah?
I put my faith in students and put my faith in my curriculum and the pedagogy I was employing, and tried to believe that this was going to make a difference, and that, you know, I mean, because here's the thing though. A lot of those schools, you know, like, they're urban schools where the teachers are really stressed out about those tests because the student population has all the challenges that jump out on these tests and that wind up with educational outcomes that people get very upset about. And in the suburbs, they don't really teach to the test. They just, for the most part, they spend a lot of time just teaching.
Right.
And the kids have all the resources and all of the stuff that supports their learning, so they wind up doing just fine on the test.
San Lorenzo, you're considering more of a suburban model school.
No, that was I should have been teaching to the test probably, but I didn't. But
yeah.
I don't teach anymore, so, you know.
Yeah.
Not full time. I have taught a little bit since then. But the thing is that, I mean, you and I were talking about this before, right? You want education to be this place where you hire the right teachers and say, you can do this. Do your best. I trust you to do your best. And then they do their best.
And what do you need?
And what do you need?
Do you need anything? Do you need help?
Would you need perhaps somebody to do those photocopies for you so that you could focus more on, like, the intellectual pursuit of crafting a good lesson?
Right. Or, you know, at like James Licken Middle and Everett Middle, where we provide enough, caring adults who can give more one-on-one attention. So a teacher will come in and split their class, and 12 students will stay with us in our pirate themed we decorate our classrooms in pirate themes in these schools, and then they can work with the other 12, you know, with smaller groups, and that's powerful, that's helpful, and you know, I just can't imagine it any other way, you know. But I obviously we're going in a different direction nationally, and
yeah,
it doesn't seem to be getting better anytime soon. And you know, the other thing that came up recently is that there's a movement for, you know, increased concentration on creativity in the classroom, and trying to figure out how you can measure that to sort of try to get it, sneak it into the correct curriculum, that we can allow teachers and to emphasize creativity and innovation and do so, and the students can be
You talked about this before we came on stage as being the difference between divergent thinking as opposed to convergent thinking.
Yeah.
Right?
So there's a guy named Torrance who was a scientist who started in the late 50s measuring creativity. There's the IQ, and then he called it the CQ, like creativity quotient. And I don't know how many people are aware of this test, but it's administered by a psychologist, 90 minutes, and it's an open-ended conversation with a student. And what they found is that the creativity, however they measured it, they say, you know, take this truck, this toy truck, how would you make it better? And, you know, questions like that encourage sort of innovation and creativity. The American scores were going up pretty steadily from when they started in the 50s to 1990. Mm. And then ever since then, they've been declining really steadily. A psychologist as William and Mary has been studying this, and his work is online and really fascinating. And a lot of it has to do with this emphasis on rote learning, convergent thinking, run one right answer,
testing,
fill in the bubbles and all that, and this sort of like measure everything and teach to the test.
How do you think we can get the American public education system, and the American education system in general, it's not public, I mean, to shift or to create room?
Well, right now there's a lot of groups like Project Zero out of Harvard that's trying to find more measurements that they can sell to legislators, basically. You know, like how do we make this, how do we add this test or add creativity and innovation, all this stuff,
so
to
we can
the
call
number
it
of measurements.
Another value added.
Yeah, because I think everybody, you know, right now everything has to be measured or else it's not valued. And it's infuriating, I think, sometimes. When we've tried to seek funding for 826, I've been in rooms with funders who have been in a room with 70 students working one-on-one with tutors who are all, they're shoulder to shoulder, they're caring adults, they're working on this, you know, first grader's homework, and you know the student's sitting there quiet and interested and having an engaged adult, and they're having a conversation, all that stuff.
And then they say, what's your logic model?
Give me the metrics on this, or prove that this works. And, you know, drives me crazy. And as a society, we're really going that way in a lot of different, forms, not just education, but this sort of emphasis on data. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that cannot be measured this way and that cannot be put in a spreadsheet. And if you're educating the whole child, the whole young person, you know, the way that these tests are administered don't come close to measuring the whole young person.
Before the program began, before you received the award, and Bianca Catalan was talking about what 826 had meant to her, and when she was talking about sitting in a classroom in at St. Mary's College, that idea that it doesn't matter how much you want to go to school, it's just denied you for reasons that are beyond your control sometimes.
Yeah.
And through Scholar Match and by providing support at 826, you've helped people help other people, you know, get beyond those obstacles. But you've got a student right now who you're working with who's doing something a little bit more about college access. Do you want to talk about that a little?
Oh, yeah. Well, three of my students in the Best American Non-Required Reading go to Unity High School out in Oakland, and they came to me one class period, and they said, you got to hear about this ballot initiative that we're part of. Some students the year before at Unity had put together this idea to provide, they did some math and they came up with a ballot initiative that would provide free college tuition for all California students to go to the UCs or the CSUs, and it would just require increased taxes for those making over $250,000. So it's a little bit like the millionaire's tax that everybody's been talking about, but and that money is going all over the place. This is focused on college exclusively, and it would be like 1% for those making over 250, another 0.5% or so for those making over 500, and it ramps up a little bit, but this would raise billions and make it possible for all students that maintain a 2.7 average and do some community service to go to school for 4 years for free. How crazy would that be, right?
That would be pretty cool. So this is, there are small programs like this that are based on philanthropic concerns, like in Kalamazoo,
Louisiana,
Kalamazoo,
you know,
Michigan. They've got the Kalamazoo Promise.
Louisiana, of all states. I was down at, I was in Baton Rouge, and they have a program there that if you get a certain amount of, you know, you do well in high school, that you get free in-state tuition. It's something that some senator years ago instilled, and they love the program, then that's a pretty good place to, pretty good reason to live in Louisiana, right? So,
but this
if
is
you had
a massive,
thing,
massive scaling up, I mean, across all of California, that would be huge.
Yeah, but think about, I mean,
I'm
there's all these proposals. I think we're hoping that one of them will pass to provide more. You know, I think that increasing taxes a little bit on the wealthy would be would help the schools K through 12 too enormously. And I think that, at least right now, the poll numbers say one of them might pass. But this program I just like because these students are fighting for it. They're here tonight, and they're going to bug you on your way out. By the way, they have the petitions here because they only need to get 10 million signatures or something like that to put it on the ballot,
and
so they make it so easy.
So they're not paid petition gatherers. We're going to call a quick audible here, I think, is that, and invite Estefania to come up on stage and give a quick pitch.
Yeah, this is Estefania Franco, one of the...
Hello. Hey. Congratulations.
Thanks.
So my name is Sophia Franco, and I go to Oakland Unity High School, and I'm a senior there. And I'm the best American art card reading. I'm a student editor. And so my high school and another high school from Oakland joined, and as a part of an economics government class, they created this ballot initiative. It all started as, hey, what if? Yeah, what if this happened? So a lot of students got involved, and the class of 2011 was able to write this whole petition and actually mail it into the secretary, and it got approved. So now the class of 2012 is trying to raise enough signatures to get this petition into the 2012 ballot. So what we, like Dave was saying, individuals who are earning $250,000 their taxes are going to increase by 1%, and those who are earning half a million are going to go up to 2%. So, I mean, that's amazing how just raising the tax, such a little small amount could make so much difference into students like me, like, you know, children of yours, grandchildren. And if this passes, it's going to be in California Constitution, in which it's going to stay there, and hopefully, you know, cross our fingers, it'll help everyone and every single one of the students here. And that's the whole point of, you know, Dave being here and helping me, helping Gabby and Christian and Carlos the Hammer. And absolutely, because, like, I definitely think education is for everyone. And this petition was written by students for students. So it'll be really, you know, amazing if you guys were able to help us, the students, and raise awareness for education here in California.
Woo!
Thank you.
Estefania Franco, ladies and gentlemen.
I mean, and it's
perhaps
not
a
just,
few years from now, you can vote for Estefania Franco for Secretary of State.
I know. They explained it so well to me, and they're so gung-ho. I was just so proud of that. When I was in high school, did I know anything about a ballot initiative? Did I have any idea about anything?
You know what would be great is if you could, you know how when you pay your taxes, there's a little box that says, like, would you like to make another contribution to, like, the presidential campaign fund or something like that? It'd be great if there was a box for people making less than $250,000 who wanted to contribute a buck or two to the program.
Yeah. Oh, sure. There you go. Add that. Stephanie, we'll just amend that right now. But it's called College for California. And
College for California.
Yeah, that's the initiative. And, you know, the other thing...
That doesn't make you a snob, does it?
Oh, God, yeah. Rick Santorum. But think about what that would do to business, even. If you were going to say, if you know, maybe the super wealthy think, oh, this is soaking me or whatever. Think about... If you had access, you know, if it was equal access to education here, and you had an infinitely better educated workforce. You mm-hmm. have people who want to move businesses to California because they know, like, oh, just like they would move to a good school district or whatever it is, they say, oh, my kids are going to go to college for free. You know, which is, you know, a pretty great incentive.
That happens already. I mean, like, people in Kalamazoo, Michigan, I mean, I've spoken to the people who run that program, and they say, like, you know, it's become more difficult to buy a house in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Why? What did, you didn't explain what they did.
Well,
did they
there was a bunch of anonymous donors put money in a trust to provide college education at a state college for all graduates of Kalamazoo Public High School.
Wow.
As long as they maintain a 3.0 or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's there, and people are, you know, considering, they're like, they live other places. They're like, well, I think I'll move there, or I think I'll put my company there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, I think at the very least we need to keep, you know, keep on this. I think that there's a lot, there's, you know, this year there's a lot of voices out there that are, you know, the teachers union is talking about, you know, they were one of the instigators of the millionaire tax, and I think people, it's out there, and I think people are ready, you know, to pay a little bit more, whether it's sales tax or income tax or whatever, to make sure that we fulfill the promise that we had made years ago for public education here in California. We've slipped a bit, but I think that we can get back there.
Was there a time in your life when education wasn't super important to you, or has it been?
When I just was anti-education, those anti-education years?
No, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, was there a point, ever a point in your life, like, even in your younger adulthood, when you were, like, too self-involved to care about stuff? But because it doesn't seem like
sure.
it, from my point of view, it doesn't,
no,
it looks
no.
like...
Yeah, of course. I mean, 826 started, I had moved back here from New York, I was 31, I guess, when we signed the lease at 826.
And, yeah, but before that, when you were at MITE, you were bringing the YMCA.
Well, I was like a camp counselor and everything growing up. I'd been babysitting and doing camp counseling since I was 13.
I'm trying to imagine this. And Dave Eggers, camp counselor.
I was a good camp counselor. I ran a sports camp, you know, and, you know, we sort of knew what we were doing, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't have a lot of oversight or measurements, and so we did our thing. But you know, every step of the way with 826, it started very small, and then it grew because we, you know, Nineveh comes on, then later on Lee Lehman, who runs the center now, comes on, and then, you know, the staff, Emily and Miranda and you know, everybody has different ideas. Like, oh, I've got an idea. We move into, the middle schools, and we need to move into the high schools this way. And then, you know, actually the first sponsor of our first book project was Isabel Allende, who had an idea. I'll pay if you guys create a book with a high school on the subject of peace and conflict. And, so we did a book with Thurgood Marshall, High School. And every step of the way, it's just about, one, we follow the needs of the teachers and the parents and the students that we work with, and B, we keep the model very flexible so mm-hmm. that we can adapt on the ground. And when the students that we had as younger kids, like Bianca or even younger, started aging up and they were applying to colleges, then we decided we needed tools to help them there. And it started with giving 5 college scholarships a year, which we still give, and we would have 150 applications for 5 students. And it was thrilling to read the resumes of these students who were so incredibly high-achieving and motivated and everything. And we would have to say no to 145 of them. And it just mm-hmm. broke our hearts. And that's when we created Scholar Match, to sort of let the community at large know about the other students and try to crowdsource and get more of them into college. Because
How's Scholar Match doing?
It's doing well. We had to adapt the model, though, because we thought it was going to be an online-only model.
Mm-hmm.
Kids post their profiles. People from the community read about them online. They donate $50 or whatever. And it turned out that most of the students we work with needed a lot more help one-on-one working out their profiles. A lot of the students didn't have, you know, laptops that they're carrying around and stuff, and Facebook profiles. And so we had to work closer to create those profiles. And then we wanted, you know, it turned into a much deeper connection that we needed between them, between the donors. And so now we've limited it to 40 students a year that we work with. And we more or less guarantee funding for those 40, as opposed to it being sort of a, you know, a less organized or, you know, more, you know, online-based thing.
Right.
And it just comes back to everything we do ends up being really human-to-human concentrated. Every time we think we're going to do something digital, it just ends up being most of the work needs to be done between two human beings looking at each other and working it out. And so the model now is the 40 students that you'll see on Scholar Match are all partnering with partner agencies like Mission Graduates or College Track or First Graduates, and we work together to make mm-hmm. sure that those 40 students are supported, are ready, have as many options as they need, and we make sure that they are supported for all 4 years. So,
what would you need to make it 80 students?
Money. Money, of course, Daniel.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, 40 is as many as we can take on with three full-time staff members. And three full-time staff members is a stretch. Everything we do is incredibly lean. We try to sort of work with, make it so that a donor's, the vast majority of their donation is going to the programming or to the scholarships. But mm-hmm. we'd love to, again, we're turning away most of our students that we would love to help, even with 40. So we need, like anything, support helps.
So we're going to be getting to your questions in just about 5 minutes. If you have, I've got a bunch in my hands, but if you've got more.
And you're judging purely on handwriting quality. Is that what we're going to be?
That's precisely correct. But if you have any, write them down or tweet them with the hashtag InformSF, and there'll be another batch coming up.
But
in a
you have
bit.
To explain. If you tweet it, there's still going to be somebody named Caroline who's going to handwrite it.
Yeah.
So you're going to tweet it. She's going to look it on her phone and then handwrite it.
So if you really want to create more work for Caroline, please do that.
Sounds good in theory, and then it's a little bit less glamorous when
One of the things that that seems to happen in your world is that these ideas kind of emerge, and then you have to locate the right person to give it life.
Yeah,
you've been really successful at that. What's the secret sauce?
Nothing works unless you hire and empower the right person, or partner with the right person, or right group, and. Yeah, I mean, from the start, hiring Nineveh, who I recruited heavily, she was teaching down in Mexico, and I said, please come back. She grew up in the city, and I worked on that for 3 months, you know, asking her to come back because I knew that the organization couldn't work without her. And she came and grew it and, you know, hired other people to work with her. And in each case, you know, Scholar Match is run by a great group, and headed up by Diana Adamson and Vicky Vertis, who had been with 826 for many years. And once they have it, you know, once they're aboard, I empower and I say, this is yours. You know, I will support you however you want to. Tell me what you need, but I'm not going to be micromanaging you. You are the boots on the ground, and I'm not going to, you know. And I think that... it's not like I can manage everybody every day anyway, but I don't want to. And I think that when you have great people, and just like if you have great educators, you need to empower them and step back. And, so that's how it works. It wouldn't work any other way if I were sitting there like checking up on everybody every minute of the day. And you know, great things happen when people feel like they're invested and they can create. You know, like at McSweeney's, we've been around for 13 years, and we've had pretty much the same subscription numbers for 13 years. You know, we exist, and we can afford like four full-time staff members, you know, to run McSweeney's. And then a guy that was an intern, Chris Ying, he came up the ranks, and he was a chef on the side, and he had an idea for a food magazine. He hooked up with David Chang from Momofuku, and they said, let's do a magazine. So I say, okay, good. I don't know anything about food. I've never read a recipe.
I eat it.
Yeah, I eat it reluctantly. And go ahead and do it. And he came up with this magazine called Lucky Peach, which in two issues has tripled our subscriptions that we have for McSweeney's in 13 years.
Wow.
It's very shaming for us in a way. It just shows, I think, people are crazy about food. And he did a great job, but all we sort of do is step back and cheer him on. And I think that that's my favorite thing, is just to sort of step back and let somebody, you know, create something and support him how you can.
Before we get to the audience questions, because I don't think anybody in the audience will know to ask you this, except perhaps your wife, and I don't think she submitted one. She might tweet one later. The HBO invited you to write a pilot.
Yeah. No, it's already over. They did, and I had an idea
that...
That
was kind of a neat gasp from the crowd, though, when I said that. That was cool.
Every writer you know right now has written an HBO pilot in the last year. I swear to God.
And most of them get spiked.
And, they commission 45 or so a year, and they film like two, which is true. That's the ratio. But they were generous enough to say, give us something. And I worked with a friend of mine, Wajahat Ali, who has been here on this stage. He's a great playwright. And... We thought that Muslim Americans aren't represented very much on primetime TV, if at all. And at this point, there was no representation until, you know, All American Muslim aired for a year. We thought how best to get a character who happens to be Muslim on TV than make a cop show. So I don't know anything about a cop show. I've never written anything like this, and Wajahat didn't either. But we said, let's make a cop show of like a Yemeni American cop working in San Francisco. So this was going to be Streets of San Francisco with a Yemeni American cop and whose family, you know, is involved. Like, you know, a lot of the Yemeni community owns some of the liquor stores out in Oakland. So they were owning, his dad owned a liquor store in Oakland, and there's all this sort of, you know, intrigue, and we thought it was good. It had a car chase at the end, like really, 8-page car chase. Like, can you imagine typing this out? And we thought it was great. And we were like, yeah, no, it didn't happen. So we just got the hammer on that a week ago, where they said
you should share it with your non-required reading students.
Yeah, that's a good idea. We talked about it on Tuesday. We talked about this show, but I'll share the script. But the idea right now is Wajahat and I might just film it, like just locally for free.
In your spare time.
In our spare time. But just to sort of put it out there so that it sees the light of day, because most scripts never do. So, I don't know. We gave it a shot. That's my one and only TV experience that will...
I'm really
the
glad
beginning
that you
and
had it.
End
That's
of
a
it.
Great idea.
I don't know. We thought it was okay. And we did research. We ride-alongs and hung out with cops in the Fillmore.
Ride-alongs are really cool. I've done a ride-along in Richmond. It was like... life-changing.
Oh,
yeah, there was like, you know, a weird drive-by, shots fired between two cars.
While you were in the car?
Not at us, but like went right by us.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really, I wore a flak jacket.
Nothing at all happened during our drive-alongs.
It was
anyway.
I did the overnight.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
I had a student do that too, actually, in East Cleveland. A student I was teaching, and East Cleveland is like the poorest city in Ohio. One of the poorest cities in Ohio, and he was really interested in it, and so he said, "Can I do a ride along with the East Cleveland police?" I was like, "Sure," and I think we asked his parents for permission later.
I think we asked his parents. Yeah,
no, I think we actually. Yeah, never mind.
All right.
To audience questions. This is from Nicole. She writes, "I tutored young elementary school kids when I was in high school, and try as I might to inspire them, when their parents didn't care about education at home and they weren't eating breakfast, I couldn't do much. How do you approach this?"
Well, that's, I think, every educator's question. How do you solve the out-of-school issues? As I like to do, I defer to somebody that knows better. What's the answer?
Well, you can bring snacks and feed children. And a lot of teachers do that.
Yeah, we feed at 826. We have snacks.
Yeah, and it is... Kids can care more than their parents do at times. I had a student who I don't think was getting a lot of support at home, and hadn't done. I used to teach 9th grade and 11th grade. She was in my 11th grade class, and you are one thirsty man. That's
just
a lot of water.
Yeah, if it's sitting there, I was going to work on yours next. So, yeah.
Anyway, She turned into a great writer in my class, and I told her that she did. And then, I mean, it's really about, like you said before, I think about those relationships and taking an interest. And often it starts with taking an interest in their lives, and then they take an interest in what you're asking them to do.
Yeah. Well, and I'll say that the kids that come every day after school at 826, their parents are super involved and super motivated. We have, right when we opened the center, I bought a couple church pews from a urban ore out in the East Bay, and we set them up there so that I wanted to make sure that if the parents wanted to come and watch and know what was going on. Well, you know, I was a Catholic, you know, and there's a lot of Catholic families and that we serve. And so every day there's 5, 6, 8 moms that are sitting watching for 2.5 hours as their kids are getting tutored. Like, that's dedication. It's always full. And so we're lucky to work with the drop-in students. The parents are gung-ho and really, you know, invested and hardcore. So, but, you know, it is that's a question that always comes up, and you answered it well.
So did you.
Thank you, Daniel.
this is from Molly, who identifies herself in parentheses as a big fan. She says, can you tell us just a little bit about your creative process? How do you invoke your muse?
Is that what
it says?
The word muse there? Okay,
yeah.
Good. You know, again, this is to get any writing done, I have to isolate myself completely. So I write in I have to have 8 hours straight in my shed in the backyard without any interruptions to get. And
do you bring food with you?
Yes, I bring food with me. Provisions, we call them, in the shed.
Sea rations.
And I sit in the writing position starting at 9. I take the kids to school. Uh-huh. Yeah. It just I have to pretend at least to get anything done. And so it takes me 8 hours to get maybe 45 minutes of work done. But if I don't have
serious?
8 hours straight, I won't get anything done. If it's interrupted by like one meeting or lunch, I don't work. So it's tough. And that's why that's why the staffs of these organizations are so, you know, autonomous and crucial, because I still have to make a living as a writer, and I need acres of time to get anything done. I'm really slow, and I procrastinate, and I do everything but, you know, and that's why the writing position is key, because at some point it'll happen. I'll type something, and it's usually late in the day. It's like 3:30. And I'm like, oh, God, I've got an hour and a half until dinner. You know, my kids are really young. And if I don't, I'm going to feel like a complete jerk, you know, because I've wasted 7 hours. And, you know, and that's where the Catholic guilt comes in. Like, you have you're able to, who has that much time during the day to waste? And now you're really wasting.
You're waiting. You're just sitting there waiting.
Yeah, like my parents really worked, you know, for a living. And here I am sitting in a shed till 3:30. Oh, self-loathing and, you know, and just.
I wonder if Molly's got a muse invocation she could share with you.
So thanks a lot, Molly. You just made me think about all that. But I do think, you know, you do have to sit for a while to at least get it. And it arrives, you know, like at some point but you do have to put yourself in that spot.
It must be different for fiction than for nonfiction.
Yeah. Fiction is fun to write, and nonfiction is not.
Really?
Yeah. No, not really. It's not much fun. The research is great, but then the writing of it, like when I wrote Zaytoun, I don't think I wrote more than 3 sentences in a row without having to check the historical record, call the Zaytoons, go back, you know. So it's not unicorns and rainbows, like la 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 la. It's really, it's a slog.
Is that what your next book is about?
Yep. No, but I just finished a novel that was like incredibly fun to write almost the whole way through, because I got to just make things up.
In that process, though, is it still sitting in the shed for multiple hours till the muse arrives?
Standing on my head somewhere, like, hey, it's the same process. You think I have a different shed for fiction? Wouldn't that be funny? The fiction shed and the nonfiction shed? That's an idea.
That's an idea.
Wow.
But I was just, I mean, it's funny.
You're so weird, Dan. I don't know. I would love to have heard you on NPR in Cleveland And people like pulling over on the side of the road in their cars, like, what did he just say? Is such a strange train of thought, this man.
All right, All right. I'm going to ask this anyway. This is from Tyler, and I'm not sure if you know who he's referring to, because I'm not sure I do, but he writes, how do you feel about Peter, now this is terrible, I don't even know how to pronounce this guy's last name, Thiel, T-H-I-E-L, but the idea is about not needing to go to college anymore. So generally speaking. This idea that college is obsolete.
Oh boy.
Listen. Well, we've just there are given always, an ad for
yeah, there are
California
always,
college.
There are always people that it's not the everyone doesn't have to take the same path, you know, for sure. And I just one of our I was talking to a young person yesterday who's just finishing up. He's interning at McSweeney's right now, but he's 28 and he's finishing up college. He took some time off in between, worked on a farm because he knew that he wasn't ready to go. And he didn't know what he wanted to learn yet. And I thought that was so admirable. This guy had it together. And he said, now he does. And he's really getting the most out of his education. And so I think that there are, as many paths as there are people. I don't think everybody has to be in lockstep, especially when it comes to graduate school and stuff and going directly. I think, I turn into one of the adults in the lives of my former students, and we talk. Bianca and I were talking about college and stuff and classes just backstage. And, on spring break, everybody comes back and visits and we talk. And, some of them want to transfer. There's infinite numbers of paths.
I think what's behind that question is the sense that college, that the curriculum in college isn't relevant or useful. That's where that question or those ideas come from. That what we really need is more technical education or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, as you know, every day there's some theorist that has a new idea, and usually they're not teachers or people with experience in education, or else they've gone to school, and so they're experts. And they have some theory, which is blow up the schools, or everyone should learn on a. by video conference, or everybody should.
YouTube.
I mean, there's always some silver bullet or some solution that everybody is, interested in for 24 hours until the next one. And nobody wants to just reinvest in, actual teachers teaching in actual public schools the way that they have for many years and adapting to the needs of that classroom. And, it works if the teachers are empowered. And,
Why is that message so hard? Like, why is it so obvious
to
you? It's
shiny.
So obvious to me.
It's not new. It's not shiny, and it isn't a silver bullet. It's hard and it's expensive. It's expensive to staff schools properly, to give them the support they need, to retain teachers, to pay them well enough, to retain them. But it doesn't say, let's give every child an iPod and we'll conquer the world. It doesn't have this sort of silver bullet mystique to it. And I hear it every day, well-informed person to me yesterday just said, hey, what do you think about, and I won't even mention this solution that's been, because...
Bandied about,
and I was like... And it's, it was a screen-oriented solution, which I'm always very skeptical about. And I thought, and we were on the campus of a very good school, good public school, and I said... Don't you see what's happening? Like 10 feet away, it's working. We have this extraordinary teacher that our kids go to class together. And why do we need this other thing, this screen and this or lasers, or it's going to be, robot teachers or whatever it is. There's always some kind of next thing instead of training, supporting, retaining great teachers.
There's this, the point in this movie, American Teacher, that came out of the book that you and I and Nineveh co-wrote, about two-thirds into it, everything kind of comes together, and there's all these statistics, and the pitch is made pretty well, I think, that there's other countries who are doing this very well, and they're just killing us on all of the international comparisons.
Yeah, and it's not iPads, and it's not lasers, it's teacher retention.
it's so obvious to you, it's so obvious to me, and it's expensive, I guess, but it's a compelling argument. Like, I just don't get why we keep...
Well, here, you know, 46% of teachers quit before their fifth year, and there's no, high-performing school system in the world that has that kind of turnover. And if until we solve that, we're in trouble.
Here's a question tweeted by at Julian Green SF. I think his name is Julian Green.
Somebody tweeted?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you for keeping Caroline busy.
Yeah.
Who helped make Dave Eggers Dave Eggers? Who was your 826?
Well, you know, I still consult with... I had a unbroken stream of great teachers growing up, and I'm still in touch with a lot of them. Most of them, you know. I'm a dork. And and there's a guy named Peter Ferry, who was a high school teacher of mine that I talk to, you know, once a week. He, at a crucial time in my life when I was like a sophomore, full of zits on every part of my body, just everywhere, like cysts, you know, I had to go in and, you know, have them injected to, you know, so I could see, you know, like I couldn't see. And I was, I didn't know what I was doing, and I was a rebellious kid. And he was my sophomore English teacher, and he had us do, and he was really sort of, you know, professorial and, you know, incredibly smart. And he said, okay, we had to do a persuasive speech. And I was like, yeah, I'll stick you persuasive speech, you know. And I did a speech about why you should take a bicycle trip to the inner mantle of the earth, right? And it was one sentence because most of it's downhill. And that was my speech. And I thought I was so funny. There's your persuasive speech. And he just sat there and laughed, and he, you know, gave me a good grade, and I couldn't shock him the whole semester. No matter which route I went or try to sort of surprise him or subvert his plan, he would validate the strangest ideas. And, as long as they were, you know, well executed. And he, you know, that really opened me up at a crucial time. I was like, boy, and you know, my art teacher and a lot of my teachers were just sort of there to let me, you know, blow off steam and sort of, they never, squelch my creativity. And they had, this was at a great high school, public high school, but the teachers were given a lot of room, to operate. And they'd been there for, you know, a long time, and they're still there. And so I think, most of what we do is emulating these teachers. The field trip that we do every day at 826 is based on, a book project that I did in first grade with Mrs. Wright. You know, we try to leave each student leaves with a student publication that they come up with. This was a few days ago, Zombie Showdown at the Scariest Place on Earth. And, you know, the kids will come in and create this story. This was March 21st. Is that yesterday? Yeah.
Yeah.
And
my daughter wrote a book recently called Don't Feed the Alligator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's tame by comparison to the zombie showdown.
I know. But, may I see this?
But if they have ideas for zombies that eat rabbits and, you know, and they, whatever it is, we'll validate that and we typeset it and bind it and illustrate it and all the students.
Can I read the first?
Yeah,
read the first, the opener, so you'll all want to buy a copy on your way out. Once upon a time, there was a flat-eared bunny named Melody who was the pilot of a super-secret spy plane. Melody couldn't wear lipstick because of her whiskers. So instead, she painted...
Third sentence in. You always get one of those. Yeah.
So instead, she painted a lightning bolt on her cheek.
It all makes sense, right?
It's available now on Amazon.
And then, you know, when the students are like in second grade and you type that up and it appears on the screen and then you print it and bind it, they're like, oh my God, you know, it's a real feeling of like, no, that's not right, or that's not good enough, or that's not, you know, that doesn't belong in print. Like when you sort of validate even their strangest ideas, I think it opens many doors.
Question here.
Daniel doesn't think they're very good, right?
No. There was one I really wanted to get to. Yeah. I saw it before. I was getting, they're all like increasing levels of goodness and awesome wonderfulness. This is from somebody named Daniel, not me. I did not tweet this while we've been sitting here. What is 826 Valencia's biggest challenge in the next 5 years?
Well, I think growth and funding are always the two things. There are a bunch of other schools, even in the neighborhood, that would like to have satellite spaces, and we would love them to have satellite spaces, and that takes money and staff. And so we just want to go deeper in the city. And and that's always just, and this is a very tough time for all nonprofits, and we happen to be doing okay, but to go deeper, you need better funding. And so there's always the students that you're not serving and the schools that you can't invite in and the field trips that are 18 months on the waiting list. And we sure wish we could say yes more and serve more students. So that's always the challenge.
Are you finding it harder, too, because schools have less resources to actually do the field trips?
Well, most of the schools walk or take public transportation. You know how hard it is to get a bus and all that. That's funding that most of these schools don't have. But, we've had instances where a school wanted to do one. They couldn't afford the bus. We try to find a funder for that field trip, and it's an eternal challenge. But luckily, there's so many schools within walking distance or, a BART ride.
Do you want another writing question? Okay. This is a anonymous question.
Yeah.
I love Zaytoon and What Is the What? I actually did too. What is your approach to writing this narrative nonfiction that makes it so compelling? I guess embedded in there is that there's a lot of narrative nonfiction that's not so compelling.
I try to take novelistic techniques and make it as compelling as a novel, and that's a matter of choosing. So you take everything that happened to the Zaytoons, and you actually have to really edit it and carve it down to what will be, have a propulsive narrative to it. And it takes a lot of, you have to edit
that
out 90% of your research, for sure.
When you were doing that with the Zaytoons, did you create some visual timeline somewhere for yourself? Like, talk us through that. What did you do?
Well, I have a binder that's 900 pages from my research that I keep in my office just to remind me not to do nonfiction again, I guess, or at least for a while. But I was obsessive about the research. I walked Zaytoon's trips, the trips that he took around New Orleans. I videotaped that over and over and over just so I knew every corner, every building. But you have to walk inside your subjects, your characters' shoes. So the other part of the answer I would say is that you have to have a lot of patience, because both of those books took over 3 years, and most of the significant work was done in that last year. When you built up a level of trust that I did with Valentino and with the Zaytoon family, where you can really break through and A, you know their story inside and out as well as they do, and better than your own almost, and B, they feel a trust and a sense that you're going to do right by their lives and their story, that they tell you things that are important, to humanize the story and make it so people can identify with them and empathize, and that's the key, I think.
Is it hard, as you're doing that, to maintain your own personal belief that you're actually going to be able to accomplish what you've set out to accomplish?
Oh, yeah. In both cases, with Valentino's story, I gave up the book 10 times. He doesn't know this, but he knows I gave up one key time when I was in Bodega Bay in a different shed I had rented to write, and I gave it up because I didn't think it was 3 years in, and I knew that I couldn't do it, and that I was going to fail, and that I'd wasted 3 years of this guy's life. And I promised him a book, and it wasn't going to happen, and I had failed miserably, and I was a bad guy. And I was in the, curled up in a corner of this shed, basically, sucking my thumb, and saying, I can't do it, I can't do it. And my wife, Vendela, said, that's fine, it's making you miserable, it's okay, Valentino will understand. And then I gave that up, and went for a bike ride, came back, showered, and in that shower, I figured out the whole book. Basically, how to make it work, how to get it done, and all that, because I had to have given it up, I think, to sort of free up my mind and sort of, how you get jammed. And So, and that's the same thing happened with Zaytoun many times. You spend most of the time writing those books wanting to give up. So have fun out there. You young people.
Go follow your dream.
Yeah, find yourself a shed. Give up most of the time. What am I saying? This is going to be on the radio.
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy.
So we're about to get to the very last question, but to make Caroline's life a little easier, I have to read something that I was supposed to read before we started recording, before we started the Q&A, the audience question part. So bear with me for just a second. As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's In Forum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're giving the 21st Century Visionary Award to Dave Eggers, acclaimed author, philanthropist, and co-founder of 826 Valencia. Now, let's go to the audience for questions. Got it.
I love that.
All right, so now, the absolute final question.
Before you do that, I just want to say, the staffs of most of the organization of A26 and McSweeney's and the people that actually run these operations, are most of whom are here.
You want to give them a round of applause?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, let's do that.
And
I was going to name everybody, but there's 17 names here. That would be bad radio, too.
That would, yeah. But I'll just say, too.
Do you want to hear our newest staff member?
Yeah.
Was one of our first scholarship students.
Really?
So Yaley Kamara won a scholarship. She went to college, went to UC Riverside, got her master's in Middlebury, spent a year in Paris speaking French.
Not too shabby.
And then she came back, and we were lucky enough to hire her. So the best thing is when students like Bianca come back and tutor, which she has mm-hmm. done many times and participates in the summer program and mentors younger students. Yaley comes back and works with us. It's all family, and that continuity means everything.
Wonderful. I should say, too, about all those all the nonprofits and the people who run them, if any of you tonight are inspired to give money to them, I know that they would love to have that conversation with you afterwards.
Don't give it to Dan, right? You're not the collector for it.
That's right. Yeah. All right, the final question, the question that is being asked of all of the speakers in the Inforum series. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Well, I'm just going to focus on the proposal that the
College
students
for California.
Will be, they'll be blocking the doors until you sign this petition. They're just trying to get signatures so at least it gets on the ballot or gets some attention. So it doesn't mean that you've voted for it yet.
By signing it, you're actually just voting for democracy.
Yeah, there you go. So I would just, it's a one sentence thing, which is just, free college tuition for all California students attending state universities. How's that?
So simple. Well, you just got your big round of applause that I was about to ask for. So,
I think Dan did a great job, don't you?
Thank you. So with that, thank you, Dave, for sharing your thoughts. And this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is now adjourned.